Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Heading out now over to Italy to speak to Tim Clark on his book Monopoly Blues. Good afternoon, Tim. How are you?
Very well indeed, and very nice to hear you.
Are you getting a heat wave in Italy as well, or not?
It seems so, yes. We've been out here for about 10 days now, and apart from one break, it's been very warm.
It sounds absolutely fantastic. Well, this is a great book, Tim, and we highly recommend it. Of course, people can buy this book that we're going to be talking about here on our website at Talk Radio Europe. We'll tell you more about that in a few moments' time. Now, this is called Monopoly Blues, and it's talking about Sub-Lieutenant Bob Clark, a 20-year-old agent with Britain's top secret special operations executive, and he parachutes into northern Italy during the war. And I suppose this has even more kind of link to it, because it's in fact talking about your dad, Tim. So, first of all, was this something known to you earlier on? Was it something you discovered later on in life? How did that come about?
It was a combination of two things, really. Actually, I knew bits of it, as my brother did as well. As we grew up, we found what one might be regarded as sort of quite odd things at home, like a commando knife, a pistol, and a naval uniform which had a parachute on it. And we didn't think that many naval officers did any parachuting. They tended to stay on the sea.
Yeah.
But my father, throughout his life, and he died about 6 years ago at the age of 89, absolutely refused to talk about it. He would tell sort of amusing stories about things that had gone wrong, but nothing really about the experiences that he had in southern Italy. He talked a bit, because it's where my father met my mother, he talked a bit about that, but not really very much. And my mother, who was more forthcoming about it and was his wireless operator, was behind the lines, so she didn't see what he did, yeah. He saw. And he didn't talk to her about it either. He never told her about it.
Which tends to be the situation with a lot of people. I know with my granddad wasn't quite as dramatic as your father's story, but nevertheless, he was in North Africa with a North African campaign, but didn't really talk about it too much to me when I was a child. And that tends to happen. What do you put down the reasoning for that? Is it just, you know, they want to kind of forget that kind of part of their life and move on to better days?
I think that's certainly part of it, and I think a big part of it. It was interesting, in the course of writing the book, I talked to a number of people, both about why their relations, like your grandfather, hadn't spoken to you about it, and it is a very common phenomenon, but also to people who had done some work and research, and I happened to meet on a flight in southern Africa, actually, completely by chance, a woman who had given psychiatric help to the fireman who had worked in New York after the 9/11 plane crashes into the building. And she said the same thing about the fireman who'd endured that experience. And I think someone said to me that people will only retell experiences like that to people that they think understand that experience. So they certainly won't say it to their families. They'll say it to friends and others who have had similar experiences or shared those experiences, but not more widely than that. And actually, one of the things that became clear to me as we did more work on the book is that clearly going back and thinking about some of these experiences would have been very difficult to him, I think.
Yeah. And, of course, let's just get into the story itself, and to get greater detail than we're ever going to have a chance to do in this next few moments,
sure.
You've got to get the book, of course. But so we're talking about Lieutenant Bob Clark. I mean, we forget, don't we, because we talk about and we see recently, of course, these older guys in their 90s. We forget these guys are in their late teens and early 20s at this point.
Very young guys. It's very much the point. I mean, he came back from the war, well, temporarily, because he went out to the Middle East afterwards, but he came back from the European War in May 1945 at the age of 21.
Wow.
And had been involved in the war for 3 years at that stage, and had to go out and find a job and get on with life at that stage. My mother's still alive, is 6 months younger than him. So both of them were immensely young. When he got to Monopoly, he was 19 years old.
Yeah, and a lot of people are, you know, down the dance halls or socialising, enjoying themselves, studying maybe at university, and these guys were doing this. So tell us a little bit about your dad, Bob, and exactly what he did. I mean, it was quite phenomenal what he did. And yet, a lot of these stories we're still learning about today through the likes of your books and others like your books.
It is. I mean, somebody said to me that that after the war, there were a lot of books that were written about the campaigns and about generals and admirals and people. But the real focus in the last 20 years or so has been what the war meant for what you might call sort of ordinary soldiers and sailors. And people now are much more interested in that. And I think that it's one of the reasons why people have been interested in the book is, you know, what was it like as a 19-year-old out of a very ordinary background in North London? How did he end up in southern Italy running boats up behind German lines on the Adriatic coast, dropping agents, putting bombs on railway lines, surveying beaches for landings and things like that? And he had no prior connections. In fact, his initial part of the war, he joined the Navy, he said, because he thought he'd get a more comfortable billet by sleeping in a bunk on a boat rather than being out in a field as a soldier.
Yeah, very good idea.
And he did do one Mediterranean convoy through Gibraltar down along to Malta. And that was obviously a very tough experience. But the Navy discovered what he already knew, which was that he was colorblind. And he'd managed to get into the Navy only by asking the man behind what the colors were, the numbers were. So he'd managed to get through that test, but then when he was actually on the convoy, they discovered he couldn't tell the difference between red and green. And so he was sent back to the Chatham dockyard as an administrator. And quite by chance, someone walked in one day and said, "Does anyone know anything about small boats?" And he said, "Well, I used to sail a dinghy on the Welsh Harp Pool before the war." And they said, "You're just the person we're looking for." So who knows what they were looking for at that stage. And he ended up being sent up to Arisaig in western Scotland in the Special Forces training area, where he trained for a month doing, well, fitness and unarmed combat, really. Was then sent down to Cornwall for training on boats, on fishing boats, motor torpedo boats, and the like. And then ended up, ultimately, in Monopoly, the title of the book, in southern Italy, just near Brindisi and Bari, at a unit called Number 1 Special Force, which was running these seaborne operations up the coast. Ultimately, as you say, he parachuted into northern Italy to act as a liaison officer with the partisans near Turin. And it was on a mission which went catastrophically wrong, and he ended up with five others being betrayed and captured. Put in civilian jails in Mondovì and then in Turin itself, and then ultimately taken up as the Germans retreated through Germany, through Munich, through Berlin, up to the north coast in Hamburg, then Lübeck, and then at the end of the war, having been in captivity for 6 months, being liberated by the British Army as it moved east across Germany.
So just to say that, as the Germans move up, they take the prisoners of war with them?
That's what they did with these prisoners. Yeah. There was a moment when, obviously, he was captured. He was Special Forces. And up until shortly before that moment, Special Forces were given no trial, were summarily executed, and had no judicial procedure at all. Extremely fortunately for my father and for the rest of us, Hitler had reversed that order a short time before, because he was worried about how the Russians would treat the increasingly youthful soldiers that were being used, in fact boys obviously, that were being used on the Eastern Front to fight the Russians as boys and old men, and he was worried that they would be treated as spies and summarily shot. So he changed the order. So my father was taken from civilian jail where he spent, or jails where he spent about 6 weeks, ultimately into prisoner of war camps where he was put with naval prisoners.
I can understand why, you know, he doesn't want to talk about this later on in life, because it's something, I suppose, that would be very harrowing for him to go through again. And you mentioned at the beginning of the interview for him to go back through some of this and to review it again. And something that I suppose many from our generation and generations beyond would never, and hopefully will never, have to relate to. And yet here he is in his early 20s having to go through this. And really his life is, and his fate is, hanging in the balance. At this moment, you just don't know what the next few days are going to hold, whether you're ever going to make it back to Blighty or not. It's just so much for a young person to take on.
You're absolutely right. I mean, one of the things, as I was writing the book with my co-author Nick Cook, and we used to talk about this a lot, that there must have been a moment when he thought he was going to survive. Yeah. And I think that that moment was when he was taken out of a civilian prison where he was there with captured partisans and others, and put into a prisoner of war camp and treated then as a naval officer. And I think it was probably then, I mean, he said to me at one stage that in the early part of his time in SOE, he thought that he might get killed, of course, he thought that he might survive, but he never thought he'd get captured. So he had no sort of preparation for that, really, although part of the SOE training did deal with capture. It didn't assume you were going to be captured very long because of the way in which they treated people who were captured.
Yeah, it really is. It's quite an amazing story. And I suppose in many ways, each time we, as you said earlier, we've always looked at generals and war strategy and so on over the years, and biographies on that. And over the last maybe decade or so, I've seen other books, and we've had other people on this show who are talking far more from a personal level. And yet, as much as you're talking about a personal family story that's for you, Tim, it echoes the war story for many people, a love story. Will he ever make it back to his girlfriend? You know, would there ever be a Tim Clark because of that? And it, you know, you get very philosophical about it all, but it is a story that tells the war story at a wider level, as well as for the Clark family.
Well, it does. I mean, it's interesting that since the book has been published, a number of people have come to Nick and I and said, as you said earlier on, you know, your grandfather in North Africa. Mm. Have said to us, my mother, father, grandmother, grandfather had similar experiences. And one of the things that we hope this book helps is to give people confidence and enthusiasm to go away and find out those stories and to write them down. Because this generation, an extraordinary generation, I think, having gone through these experiences, they are rapidly disappearing. I mean, SOE, for example, there's hardly anyone now still alive who was a field officer. And so unless these stories are written down, they will disappear.
Yeah.
And it's been really encouraging, I think, people coming and saying that I now like to do the same thing, because Nick and I started, I remember right at the very beginning, Nick said to me, go away and write down everything you know about your father and mother's story. And it covered 5 pieces of A4. So over the period of 5 years it took to write the book, we had to really recreate almost the entire story. We had, as I said earlier, sort of snippets of it. And we had my mother, and in a sense, you know, her story is no less incredible than my father's. She gave up Oxford in order to join the Women's Army. She was trained as a wireless operator. She was sent at the age of 19, having grown up in a Welsh village, to Monopoly. And that's where she met my father. So, as you said, there's a sort of romantic story, a sense in which good came out of this appalling series of challenges that they both faced down there.
And is it coincidental that you're in Italy now, or are you retracing some of the steps anywhere nearby?
It is sort of coincidental. I've thought about that. We spend quite a lot of time in Italy. My parents, funnily enough, didn't really bring the family to Italy for quite a long time. Mm. And But we did, in the sort of late 60s, have a, I remember a family holiday going down to southern Italy and going to Monopoly. And my brother and I, who were sort of, he was early teens, I was mid-teens, were rather baffled about why we were going to this place. But they never, apart from that one time, they never really went back. I mean, the curious thing is my father parachuted as liaison officer, spoke no German at all. He said he could explain to partisans how to strip a brain gun in Italian, but that was all. He had no other Italian.
You never know when you're going to need
German.
It.
Yeah. So, you know, it was entirely new to him. But he started coming back more in later life. He started having holidays, or my mother and him having holidays, in southern Italy and coming back down there. And as more was done, and as one of the stories in the book that you will have seen about meeting again this partisan who met him when he parachuted, Sergio Coretti, then they did come to Italy every year to meet Sergio and his family, and Sergio would come on the other years. Those meetings were extraordinary too, because yeah. Sergio spoke no English and my father spoke no Italian, and they would spend days together talking to each other.
Wow. Well, Tim, thank you for coming on, sharing your story. And of course, the book's called Monopoly Blues. It's available if you go to our website. You can go to tre.radio, click on the bookshop banner there, and you can order yourself a copy here in Spain of that book, Monopoly Blues, by Tim Clark. Tim, thanks for coming on. It's a tremendous story, and there we are. It will always be around, hopefully, for others to read.
I hope so. Thank you very
Lovely.
Much indeed, Doug.
Take care.
All
God
right.
bless. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.